What Granny had told me scrambled that image completely, causing ugly words to flash across my mind. Uncle Tom, collaborator, house nigger. Ironically, Obama's sympathies are entirely reserved for his father, even though Obama Sr. only experienced colonialism as a child. Obama is deeply touched to hear about his father walking miles to school, proudly bringing his grades back home to his parents, and eventually moving to the port city of Mombasa, where he became active in politics. In 1952, Obama Sr. was briefly jailed during the emergency declared by the British to deal with the Mau Mau uprising. After his release, Obama Sr. made his connection with Mboya and continued his involvement in the anti-colonial cause. Then, thanks to the two missionary women, he got his big chance to go to America. For Obama Jr., this was the great moment, his father's chance to make a difference and change his country and the world. But tragically, the promise was never fulfilled, and his father died a broken man. One might attribute this to his father's chronic carelessness and irresponsibility, both with himself and with others. But Obama Jr. views those characteristics as themselves shaped by colonial victimization. Somehow, the badge of inferiority and humiliation, somehow the sharp currents of history that no one talks about, these are responsible for denying Barack Obama Sr. his rightful dream. For Obama, the dream is non-negotiable. It is everything. Anyone who denies it is beneath contempt. In Nairobi, Obama is happy to commune with his relatives, most of them doing nothing with their lives, the men looking for government benefits, the women for men who will provide for them. But then he encounters one of his own half-brothers, Mark. Mark, the son of Barack Sr. and Ruth Nidasand, seems a lot like Obama. He received his undergraduate degree from Brown and his master's from Stanford, both in physics. Mark then lived and worked in the United States. Since then, he got his MBA from Emory and is now a business consultant living in China. In another sense, however, Mark could not be more different from his half-brother Barack. He professes no real attachment to Kenya, just another poor African country. And when Obama asks, "You don't think about settling here?" Mark replies, "There's not much work for a physicist, is there, in a country where the average person doesn't have a telephone?" Mark also changed his last name from Obama to Disanjo, relinquishing his own dad's name and taking the name of the man who married his mother after she divorced Barack Sr. Surprised by Mark's indifference, not only to Kenya, but also to his own father, Obama persists. "Don't you ever feel like you might be losing something?" Mark replies, "You think that somehow I'm cut off from my roots, that sort of thing." "Well, you're right. At a certain point, I made a decision not to think about who my real father was. He was dead to me, even when he was still alive. I knew he was a drunk and showed no concern for his wife or children. That was enough." Shocked by Mark's disdain for his idol, Obama presses him. "That doesn't bother you? Being numb, I mean?" Mark compounds the offense. "Towards him, no. Other things move me. Beethoven's symphonies, Shakespeare's sonnets. I know it's not what an African is supposed to care about, but who's to tell me what I should and shouldn't care about? Understand, I'm not ashamed of being half Kenyan. I just don't ask myself a lot of questions about what it all means. Who knows? What's certain is that I don't need the stress. Life's hard enough without all that excess baggage." At this point, Obama is done with Mark. Outside, we exchanged addresses and promised to write, with a dishonesty that made my heart ache. Obama doesn't want to see his brother again. The temptation has presented itself, the temptation to deny his father and his African homeland, and he has successfully resisted it. In the climax to his narrative, Obama visits the burial mounds of his father and grandfather. This scene is absolutely pivotal for Obama's development. Obama himself recognizes this, and he leads up to it with a sense of drama and trepidation. First, he describes going out into the wilderness past a group of painted Maasai. What follows is virtually biblical. We came upon a tribe of hyenas feeding on the carcass of a wildebeest. In the dying orange light, they looked like demon dogs, their eyes like clumps of black coal, their chins dripping with blood. It was a savage scene, and we stayed there for a long time, watching life feed on itself, the silence interrupted only by the crack of bone or the rush of wind. I thought to myself, this is what creation looked like. The same stillness, the same crunching of bone. There in the dusk, over that hill, I imagined the first man stepping forward, naked and rough-skinned, grasping a chunk of flint in his clumsy hand, no words yet for the fear, the anticipation, the awe he feels at the sky, the glimmering knowledge of his own death. Why is Obama raising the issue of creation? Because his narrative is really about his own death and rebirth. Next, Obama describes his granny braiding hair as she sits him down outside their family hut and tells him about himself. This is Obama's book of Genesis, and so predictably he writes, "I asked Granny to start from the beginning." Granny's beginning has a very familiar tone. First, there was Miwiru. It is not known who came before. Miwiru sired Sigoma. Sigoma sired Owini. Owini sired Kosori. Kosori sired Ogelo. Ogelo sired Otondi. Otondi sired Obongo. Obongo sired Okoth. And Okoth sired Opio. Granny describes the idyllic times before colonialism. This is the time before the white man came. Each family had their own compound, but they all lived under the laws of the elders. Men had their own huts and were responsible for clearing and cultivating the land, as well as protecting the cattle from wild animals and the raids of other tribes. Each wife had her own vegetable plot, which only she and her daughters would cultivate. She cooked the man's food, drew water, and maintained the huts. The elders regulated all plantings and harvests. The children did not go to school, but learned alongside their parents. The girls would accompany their mothers and learn how to grind the millet into porridge, how to grow vegetables and pack clay for the huts. The boys learned from their fathers how to herd and work pangas and throw spears. As Obama hears his family history, he's moved into a kind of reverie. How to explain the emotions of that day? I can summon each moment in my mind, almost frame by frame. It wasn't simply joy that I felt in each of these moments. Rather, it was a sense that everything I was doing, every touch and breath and word, carried the full weight of my life. That a circle was beginning to close, so that I might finally recognize myself as I was here, now, in one place. Obama takes the Great Kenyan Railroad from Nairobi to Kisumu. Obama knows his colonial history. The railway had been the largest single engineering effort in the history of the British Empire at the time it was built. 600 miles long, from Mombasa on the Indian Ocean to the eastern shores of Lake Victoria. It seemed like ancient history. And yet I know that 1895, the year that the first beams were laid, had also been the year of my grandfather's birth. The thought made the history of the train come alive for me, and I tried to imagine the sensations some nameless British officer might have felt on the train's maiden voyage as he sat in his gas-lit compartment and looked out over miles of receding bush. I tried to imagine the African on the other side of the glass window, watching this snake of steel and black smoke passing his village for the first time. Before he visits the family gravesite, Obama is given some small but priceless mementos of his own ancestry. He gets a domestic servant's pocket register that his grandfather once possessed, along with some of the old man's letters. More valuable, he gets a stack of letters that his own father wrote to various American colleges: Morgan State, Santa Barbara Junior College, San Francisco State, seeking admission. "Dear President Calhoun," one letter begins, "I have heard of your college from Mrs. Helen Roberts of Palo Alto, California, who is now in Nairobi here. Mrs. Roberts, knowing how much desirous I am to further my studies in the United States of America, has asked me to apply to your esteemed college for admission." And so on. Obama cannot believe what he is holding in his hands. "This is it," he writes. "My inheritance." Finally, Obama visits the grave where both his grandfather and father are buried. Briefly, he recalls his grandfather. But then, the picture fades, replaced by the image of a 9-year-old boy, my father. How lucky he must have felt when his ship came sailing in. He must have known, when that letter came from Hawaii, that he had been chosen after all, that he possessed the grace of his name, the Baraka, the blessings of God. With the degree, the ascot, the American wife, the car, the words, the figures, the wallet, the proper proportion of tonic to gin, the polish, the panache, the entire thing seamless and natural, without the cobbled together, haphazard quality of an earlier time, what could stand in his way? He had almost succeeded, in a way his own father could never have hoped for. And then, after seeming to travel so far, to discover that he had not escaped after all. At this point, Obama is simply overcome with emotion. I dropped to the ground and swept my hand across the smooth yellow tile. "Oh, Father," I cried, "there was no shame in your confusion, no shame in the fear. There was only shame in the silence fear had produced. It was the silence that betrayed us. If it weren't for that silence, your grandfather might have told your father that he could never escape himself or recreate himself alone. Your father might have taught those same lessons to you. And you, the son, might have taught your father that this new world that was beckoning all of you involved more than just railroads and indoor toilets and irrigation ditches and gramophones." Obama continues, "For a long time I sat between the two graves and wept. And from that weeping came something new, something that wasn't there before. When my tears were finally spent, I felt a calmness wash over me. I felt the circle finally close. I realized that who I was, what I cared about, was no longer just a matter of intellect or obligation, no longer a construct of words. I saw that my life in America, the black life, the white life, the sense of abandonment I'd felt as a boy, the frustration and hope I'd witnessed in Chicago, all of it was connected with this small plot of earth an ocean away, connected by more than the accident of name or the color of my skin. The pain that I felt was my father's pain." A light rain begins to fall, and Obama feels a tap on his arm. His half-brother, Bernard, says, "They wanted me to see if you were okay." Obama smiles. "Yeah, I'm okay." Finally, he is okay. As Obama's writing shows, he has moved into a higher mode, suspended, as it were, above the plane of mundane reality. For the second time, Obama has had a transforming experience with his father. The first time was when Barack Sr. came to speak at his school in Hawaii. That's when the son resolved to imbibe his father's personality, his magnetic charm, his persuasiveness. But here, at the family tomb, Obama receives something more fundamental. In Obama's own words, "I sat at my father's grave and spoke to him through Africa's red soil." In a sense, through the earth itself, he communes with his father and receives his father's spirit. It is here that Obama takes on his father's struggle, not by recovering his father's body, but by embracing his father's cause. And so he makes his decision. Where Obama Sr. failed, Obama Jr. will succeed, but he will succeed calmly, strategically, using the panache and persuasiveness that he also got from his father. Obama Sr.'s hatred of the colonial system becomes Obama Jr.'s hatred. Obama Sr.'s failed attempt to set the world right becomes Obama Jr.'s objective for the future. As Obama himself puts it, the dreams of the father forge the dreams of the son, and through a kind of sacramental experience at the family grave, the father's struggle becomes the son's birthright.